Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Before, say, about the year 2000, if we went out on the street and stopped people and asked them if they could define the word blog, I think probably most people would have drawn blank. Today, however, by one estimate at least, there are over 112 million blogs. And they get a lot of attention. The phenomenon certainly has gotten a lot of attention, and specifically blogs that deal with politics have gotten a lot of attention. In fact, many people today say that they find the political blog to be their preferred source for political news. This morning, in this first hour of the show, we'll be exploring the impact of the blog on American politics. And our guest for the program is David Perlmutter. He is professor and associate dean for graduate studies and research at the William Allen White School of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Kansas. And he is the author of the book Blog Wars. It's published by the Oxford University Press. He has also written for, or his writing has appeared in, many different publications, the LA Times, Christian Science Monitor, International Herald Tribune. He is the author or editor of 7 books and many research articles on politics and the media. He's been a columnist for the Chronicle of Higher Education. He's also editor of the blog of the Robert J. Dole Institute of Politics at the University of Kansas. That's www.doleinstituteblog.com. .org if you want to take a look at it. And of course, you can head out to the bookstore and find the book, Blog Wars, and look at that as well. As we talk this morning, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number and calls on us. So if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana over the air, or listening across the country on the internet, either way, you can use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL or 9455, and toll free, 800-222-9455. Calls are certainly welcome here. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to keep their comments brief. Professor Perlmutter, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Certainly the growth in the number of blogs is pretty stunning. I think you note in the book that whoever it was that was the first person to try to estimate how many there were. And I think this was in 1999. There were maybe about 20. And that now, at least this one estimate, Technorati, that's their estimate. They said more than 112 million. And I think also in the book that you note that there is somebody who says that a new blog is created every second. So that's a pretty stunning kind of growth in the number of blogs and people blogging, and I expect also people reading them.
Well, it reflects that the popularity of blogging, of course, but also that what people used to call a web page, a personal web page in, say, 1996, is now called a blog. And things that used to be called columns in 1998 are now called blogs. So blogging has sort of taken over what used to be the niche of the personal website.
Well, is what people are doing with it that much different, that it's deserving of either more attention or a different name, or is it just that the number has grown, or is it something about what's happening on those web pages that has also changed?
I think there's been a critical reaction en masse of, first, the technology has become very simple. You know, you can get on and through Blogger and start up a blog literally within minutes. It'll take you a little while longer to make it look nice, but anybody can really start a blog if you have web access, whether you're in an internet cafe in Zambia or in some province in China where there's one computer in the village. So access is easy. It's very simple to create the content. I mean, essentially, the content of a blog is what you think, and most people have opinions on subjects. And so of that 112 million, there are many different types. I mean, there's medical blogs, there's people who blog about their family, people who blog about their pets. It's just become a very easy way for people to express themselves through the web. And then, of course, there's the interactivity feature, that blogging is the ability to talk to other people through the internet and have them react to you, to speak up and also speak out on issues and also have people comment on what you're saying.
Yeah. I think the point that you're making here is that, and we don't want to minimize the importance of blogs in politics and the kind of information that's there. But on the one hand, you seem to be saying that the content, it's not so much the content that's revolutionary. It's the fact that, as you say, relatively easily, someone can go way beyond what you could do by talking to your neighbors or going in the town square and standing on a box and talking to anybody who would listen who was happening to pass by. It's the matter of putting into the hands of most anybody the tools of mass communication and making it possible, at least, for them to speak to a very, very large audience spread literally all over the world.
Yeah, there's been a significant change in the input and output of information. I'm old enough to remember my parents were very much interested in news and information. Well, but still, we watched the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. I think they subscribed to both Time and Newsweek, a couple of newspapers. They got some specialty newsletters. That was about it in terms of receiving information about, say, what's going on in foreign countries. On the other hand, if you wanted to talk back, if you wanted to say something within the news stream, you pretty much had to be a journalist or write an article as a politician or a professor. I remember an old genre that used to be that when TV stations did an editorial, you could write in and say, now responding to our editorial as a local citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And that was or you wrote a letter to the editor. That was pretty much the only way to get into the news stream. And now, technically, anybody can start up a blog and comment on Iraq or the presidential election and become their own, essentially, a newspaper.
Well, if you take a look at what we know about who is who's creating blogs, as you said, that the requirements are relatively minimal. You got to have a computer, you got to have internet access, and you've got to be able to know how to make it work. Although, as you say, the tools there are available and they're pretty simple. They're the kind of thing that most people, if they decided they really wanted to do it, they could do it. But having said that, what do we know about who it is that's doing all this blogging?
Well, first, a lot of people are trying blogging. You're having 10, 15, 20% of people in surveys saying that they've tried blogging. Blogs die off very quickly. There's a huge dead pool of no longer updated blogs where somebody tried it for a couple of weeks and said, gosh, you know, I've got to start writing something new. It's just too much trouble. I think I'll stop. Or they get one nasty email and they stop. The people who are consistently politically blogging and updating week after week and you go there and they're still there, they're building an audience. If you look at the surveys Pew Center, others, including ourselves, have done internationally and in America, it's a very interesting profile. It is not the 13-year-old kid in his basement. Bloggers, people who have political blogs, tend to be middle class, tend to be educated. They tend to be people who get involved in politics in other ways, like giving money or sending letters to candidates. I mean, they do traditional political things. So they're not a fringe phenomenon. They're really almost at the center of American politics.
We know that there are a lot of blogs that exist, that are created and exist, and certainly they deal with politics, but a lot of other subjects as well, very wide range. If you ask, well, do we have some kind of good number of how many people are regularly reading blogs? Not these aren't the people that are creating them and posting, but perhaps people who simply do log on and in an average week or month look at them and read them. Any sense of what that number is?
Well, you're having as many as half the people who go on the web to look for political information saying that they've consulted a blog at least once, and you're getting 10 to 15 to 20% of people who go on the web and look for political information regularly consulting blogs. In terms of how many voters that is, I think you'll find it's a disproportionate number of voters. As you know, in politics, sometimes raw numbers is not as important as, say, who shows up to vote. In the election, you know, that's the final number that counts, who gives money. And so it's a pretty prime constituency for politicians to pay attention to, and you can see that in the way that the political calendar has changed with an orientation not only towards the Internet in general, was towards blogging. The Daily Kos, which is the largest community left and liberal progressive blog, they have a yearly convention, which used to be called the Kos Convention, but now is going to be called the Netroots Convention. All the major Democratic presidential candidates went to visit there. It was like the AFL-CIO yearly dinner. So the politicians are paying attention because it's a very important constituency within parties and also within general fundraising communities.
So people who are spending a lot of time reading blogs, they are people who are intensely interested in politics, very motivated to read about it, and no doubt, among all those other things, these are actually people who vote. Maybe they're likely people who would give money to a political campaign. So you can understand why campaigns would be really interested in getting these people's attention.
Yes.
If you take a look at again, we're talking about political blogs. If you take a look at their political orientation, according to, you know, conventional kind of labels, libertarian, conservative, liberal, you know, whatever, how does that break down? And are they equally, do they fall equally along the political spectrum in terms of left to right?
Most surveys I've seen show that the left part of the spectrum of blogging tends to dominate in numbers and perhaps you might even say influence as well. And there have been a lot of speculation about why that's so. One argument that I think has validity is that until the congressional elections of a few years ago, the Republican Party conservative ideology was dominant in the country, and so it sort of made sense that when an opposition group is coming along and they want to have a voice and they want to organize, they'll seize on new technology. It's sort of like the old thing from military affairs that the losers of the last war are the first innovators in new technology for the next war. So in some ways, during the years of the beginning of the Iraq War and the first term of the Bush presidency, it was the left that sort of was much more motivated to figure out ways to organize themselves in opposition. If we have a presidential election now where there's a 60-vote in the Senate Democratic majority and there's a Democratic president and Republicans conservative feel out, maybe they'll take it up. In fact, there's a lot of discussion in conservative blogs about that maybe being their chance to reorganize themselves on the Internet and blogging. That not to say there aren't conservative and influential and conservative political blogs out there, just that most people recognize the left tends to dominate at this point.
Mm-hmm. As we'd said, that the people who are involved in political blogging, that is the ones who are creating the blogs and the ones who are posting and perhaps the ones who are just reading, these are the people who are really intensely interested in politics and may also be not just interested but also active in politics locally, nationally, people who follow campaigns, issues, candidates, who may be willing to work for campaigns, willing to certainly give money to campaigns. Would these have been people who, before there was the opportunity to blog, who were doing all those things to the extent that they could? That is, they were involved in politics in the ways that it was possible to be involved. Or has this somehow drawn people in to become involved, and then perhaps go on from there to do some of these other things, maybe become more involved in politics in their local community, for example. So has this actually brought people more into politics, or are these people who essentially were involved before?
Well, yes to all of the above. If you look at people who work in political campaigns, either in consulting firms or for parties or for candidates, politics in the field is a game for the young. There's a lot of 20-somethings working 20-hour days out there. If you ask them how they first got involved physically in politics, a lot of them will tell you that it was through social interactive media like blogging. So I started a blog at my college, or I was involved in the, you know, the MySpace page at for my Democratic Party at my college or something like that. So that's an entry point for young people into politics because it's the way that they think. You know, we tend to use this term new media to describe MySpace, Facebook, YouTube, blogging, text messaging. But, of course, to somebody who's 18 today, it's not new media. It's the wheel and fire. They've just grown up with it. It's the way that they seek information. So it has brought a lot of new people into politics because that's the gateway and the portal to doing it. If it had been 30, 40 years ago, political scientists, you know, the way that they've measured political participation was, do you vote? Do you give money? Do you show up to a campaign rally? I bet that some of these same people would have been, if there had been no internet, doing those things. And now they're doing them, but they're also doing them online.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, David Perlmutter, he is professor and associate dean for graduate studies and research at the William Allen White School of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Kansas. And he is the author of the book Blog Wars, which takes a look at the phenomenon of the political blog. It's published by the Oxford University Press, trying to ask some basic questions about what they are, who's doing it, and what sort of impact blogs, political blogs, have had on politics in the United States. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We talked about the fact that to start a blog is relatively easy. You need the basic stuff. You need the computer. You need to be able to connect with the internet. The tools are there, and that's not that hard, and that you could probably have a blog up and running in under an hour, depending on what it was that you want it to look like. So we mentioned, in fact, I mentioned this statistic that a new one's being created every second. So there are a lot of blogs about a lot of different subjects, but not all of them political. So you have a lot of blogs out there, and yet they're not all equally important. I'm sure that there are some blogs that are maybe only read by a very small number of people, depending on what you're interested in. But then now there are some blogs that have very large audience, a lot of people reading them. What makes the difference between a blog that's in a position to be influential because there's a big readership and something else that's just – it's an expression of that person's interest and maybe their friends read it and a few other people read it, but it's not going to be read by people all across the country?
Well, first, as I said, it's easy to start a blog, but that's almost like saying it's easy to start a baby. but it's the daily work, as all parents can testify, that can be difficult. If you just imagine those Japanese computer pets on the watch, I don't know if they still have them, where day you had to like play with them an hour and feed them, and if they didn't, they just died. Well, one of the reasons a lot of people start up a blog and then just give up is just to sustain it for an audience. I mean, newspaper columnists like Art Buchwald used to complain about having to write two columns a week. Bloggers essentially have to, political bloggers who are very active and engaged and want to build audiences and want to keep audiences, they're writing the equivalent of four or five columns a day. That's incredibly difficult. I know I can't do it, and my hat's off to those bloggers who can pull it off. One of the solutions has been, and the most read blogs out there tend to be the very large community blogs like Daily Kos on the left or Town Hall and Red State on the right, where there's a lot of people blogging together on the same site. But because of the difficulty of sustaining it and also the question of, you know, what is your objective? If you started a blog to update your family on your vacation in the Grand Canyon and the only thing you care about is that your extended family reads your blog, well, that's fine. That's success. But if you start a blog with the intention of you know, throwing down the New York Times and National Public Radio until they scream for mercy, you know, good luck. You know, that's a pretty high benchmark to try to reach. There are obviously blogs like Coast where hundreds of thousands, millions of people are reading them, and then others, they're read pretty much only by the author, yes.
Mm. Well, that does say something about how blogging can be an all-consuming activity. That is, it can soak up an awful lot of your time. That is, if you have a blog and you are creating content and putting it out there, even people who are big blog readers, I don't know how it is. I mean, myself, I feel like I can hardly keep up with the old media, as opposed to spending a couple hours a day reading blogs. I'm not exactly sure where people find the time.
No, you need a certain obsession to do it, as much as you need a certain obsession to be a radio personality or to be a radio journalist or to be a television or print journalist. I mean, you need to be really a dedicated person to what you're doing, and that's always going to be a smaller percent of the population than people who just want to start something and try it out. As I said, I am unable to blog at the rate or the extent that the political bloggers that I studied do. It's just too hard for many different reasons, and my hat's off to them. And that's something else I tell people who are saying, well, I want to start a political blog. I say, okay, well, wait a minute. Now, let me just tell you what it's going to entail. I had one blogger I interviewed, his a modest-sized political blog, and I asked him how much it cost to run his blog, and he said $100,000 a year. And what he meant was that it cost him like $10 to actually run the blog, but $100,000 in lost time for his work. So all of these things need to be balanced in your decision whether you're going to have a political blog or not.
Well, people who create the blogs and who read them, this is a very passionate, to say the least, audience. And that, I think, it's the idea that you're trying to get at with the title, Blog Wars. That is that within the blogosphere, the people who have political blogs, and particularly if they run to the ideological opposites, it's where the war is going on. It's they're at war with each other, in the sense, because there's this constant verbal, ideological battling back and forth about issues and about who has the right approach and who said what. And people can get very, very worked up about what's said in blogs and what's said about them if they're writing on the blogs. And so the war that you're talking about is the war that's raging in cyberspace, and probably unless something breaks out, something that happens on a blog breaks out and gets the attention of the old media, that's probably the time when it's least likely that most people are going to pay attention to what's going on. And I guess I'm still thinking about this. Is this a war that just pretty much involves the committed combatants, or does it really have impact outside of that circle of people who are hardcore bloggers and readers of blogs?
Well, it can. And obviously there are many issues that are raged and debated in the blog lands which don't make it to massive saturation, traditional media attention. Some do, and that's why a lot of journalists pay attention to blogs. A lot of politicians, political workers read blogs, and these so-called blog-throughs, and you think of things like the Dan Rather Memogate affair. I one example that I find interesting is that back in early 2006 and then later in 2007, I wrote some pieces about how, yes, Hillary Clinton was far ahead of everybody else, including a senator from Illinois that nobody had heard of at that time. And everybody was talking about she's going to have a $300 million war chest, and she's 30 points, 20 points ahead of everyone. And I was noticing that in the left and progressive and liberal blogs, that was not a very happy situation. They were not looking forward to a Clinton nomination for the Democratic candidate for president. And they were just saying, look, these are the problems with Clinton, and can't we find somebody better? And then I thought it was interesting that Barack Obama has come along with a campaign that not only married very good traditional political groundwork, you know, get out the vote, and speeches and so on, but with a very sophisticated internet activation and outreach strategy. Well, I would say that in some ways blogs sort of set that up and sort of kept the fires burning of we will not accept an inevitable Clinton candidacy.
Well, how many cases, and maybe you have cited some, could you say that a political blog really broke a big story?
Well, I think part of the debate about that is whether a story would have eventually been broken, but maybe a week later. And I'm thinking something like, let's just take YouTube, which essentially is a video blog. You know, people post things and then comment on it, except the things are videos. The macaca moment in the Allen campaign for Virginia. This is another significant change in politics, because I'm old enough to remember when the politician could get away with giving a speech to one group in one town and saying one thing, and then fly to another town and say the opposite. if there were no journalists in the room, you were safe. But now everybody with a cell phone is a potential journalist to out you on what you said in front of one particular group. Well, in that macaca moment there, you know, there was one person taking a video and he put it up on YouTube. That's happening a lot, and I think even if it doesn't make major news every time, political campaigns, and especially the younger political workers, are very well aware of it, and it's sort of changing the tone and tenor of politics. And so 2008 is our revolutionary year. Where the revolution is going to go, I mean, what's going to be the new republic of the internet and blogging and social interactive media, I don't know. But it definitely the change is occurring just simply because of the people who are the politicians and the political workers. That's the way they think.
Our guest is David Perlmutter. He's author of the new book, Blog Wars. It's published by the Oxford University Press. He's professor and associate dean for graduate studies and research at the William Allen White School of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Kansas. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Is it the case that there are blogs that are maintained by individuals, and then there are blogs that, as you say, are kind of communities of individuals? There are blogs that are something that's starting to approach a newspaper or news magazine in a sense that exists in electronic form. And perhaps those are the blogs that are going to get some of the most attention, although there are blogs that are maintained by individuals that certainly do get attention. Is there, I guess I'm still searching for a way in which, say, something like the Daily Kos or the Huffington Post or something like that is substantially different from, well, say, an online magazine like Slate or Salon?
I think you're going to see a lot of merging and melding, including some leveraged buyouts and purchases of these, because I think so-called traditional media are finding that they have to extend their reach into this area. Obviously, I know a lot of journalists who are writing blogs in addition to their journalism, or being forced to by their newspapers who want to have something more modern on the website. So you're going to see a lot of what used to be traditional elements of journalism becoming part of blogging. One thing that's interesting is blogging, when it first began, essentially was opinion writing. People saying, okay, here's what I think about what happened today in Iraq, or here's an article I read in the paper today, this is what I think of it. But there are a lot of people now who are creating original journalism, who are independent people in Iraq who are reporting directly without working for a newspaper affiliate or a press service. Military blogging, war blogging has become huge, where we're hearing directly from a Marine Corps major in Fallujah what happened today. No reporter, no editing, just him directly. Experts, foreign policy experts, professors of this, who are blogging, and lawyers who are blogging their specialty area. So blogging has become pretty diverse. It's not just somebody ranting about Iraq.
You started to get really interested in the political blog. This was in when Howard Dean was running for president. Is that right?
Yes. Basically, since 1996, I had been studying politics online, and I tried to go to Iowa in the year before the presidential race to sort of see how campaigns build up. And in 2003, what I noticed, that there was a campaign for this former governor of Vermont, pretty obscure person, who was trying something really new. Back in 96, when I looked at presidential campaign websites with a colleague of mine, we pretty much called them web-based tack boards. That is, people just pasted, here's my speeches, here's some pictures. Mm-hmm. There was no interactivity. 2000, John McCain's campaign sort of pioneers the campaign website as ATM, as money donation machine. But 2003, 2004, Howard Dean, Joe Trippi, Jerome Armstrong, people are, they're pioneering the idea of, can we build an interactive political campaign? And the campaign didn't succeed in the sense that Howard Dean wasn't elected president, but of course there's no new technology in the world that works the first time perfectly that it's sent out. Remember the Apple Newton. I just thought it was a very interesting experiment, and I think that experiment has come to fulfillment in this election.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now do you see, I'm sure the answer is yes, you see candidates who are using, they're using the web as a method of communication. They're certainly using it to raise money. And now we've seen candidates who've been very, very successful raising just a staggering amount of money over the web. Certainly Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama did. but they're also using it as a communication tool that somehow reaches people in ways that the other more conventional tools, television, I suppose, would be one. It seems to have at least create the possibility of a more personal and perhaps interactive kind of communication than anything else that we've got.
Well, that's the theory. Unfortunately, the problem is that if you have a presidential candidate, that person still doesn't have any more time to run for president than they did in 1936. the day is still 24 hours, and it's just hard to imagine that any candidate is going to say, well, you know, I'm going to take a couple hours off to blog now. There's just so much else they have to do. Now, it is true in the case of Obama, who raised a lot more money on the web, is that when you've got the fundraising machine going on the Internet, that frees up. You have to go to many fewer fundraising dinners, you know, with 1,500. If you've got a website where 10,000 people donate $100, there's fewer dinners you have to go to for 20 people who give you $1,000. So blogging is opening up all these possibilities, but it's more people on the campaign, people working on behalf of the campaign, but also independent bloggers supporting the candidate rather than the candidate themselves. I still think if you're running for office and anything above mayor, I just don't see how you have enough time to be interactive with 100,000 people.
How many people, I guess, take advantage of that? The number of people who are ever going to even lay eyes on a candidate in the flesh, much less shake hands with them or talk to them, is very, very small. Now, here is an opportunity, at least, for people to make some kind of comment that's going to get to the campaign. I mean, no, who knows what happens with that? But do people take advantage of that? And our campaigns at least creating the opportunity to say, here you go on to our website or whatever, and tell us what you think are the most important issues. Tell us what you think we should be doing about issue X. Tell us anything. Tell us whatever you want, and that someone at least will read that.
Yes, I think it's partly people organizing themselves. I look at Rand Paul, for example, who was able to raise many millions of dollars more than the candidacy of his type would normally do, mostly by people independently setting up their Rand Paul for President website. Now, there's a tension there. Traditional politics is all about discipline and control of the message. The message comes out of the central committee of the campaign. This is our message of the day. This is our soundbite of the day. And everybody down the line, down to the local precinct worker, is supposed to replicate that and pass that on. When you've got 50,000 ad hoc Obama for President websites and committees and blogs, they're not going to take a talking point of the day. They're just going to come up with that day with what they want to say about Obama. That's a lot of tension, especially for traditional political consultants who are into control. That is going to be one of the great interesting things of this election, is that all the people saying independently things that candidates may or may not have to disclaim the connection to or deny responsibility for.
Mm-hmm. Often the media are criticized, particularly the most dominant media, in a sense, for being on the same page. Saying that whatever the top story is, all having the same story, in a sense having some of the same kind of analysis and reporting of that story. And what seems to be one of the interesting things about political blogs and about the blogosphere is that now here's an opportunity for a lot of people to do fact-checking, to do media criticism, to say something like, you know, I think that the media here has got the story wrong, or they got the wrong story. Do you think that there are interesting examples where what is sometimes called the mainstream media, so that's like the big television networks and the cable casters and the big newspapers and so forth, really ended up having to deal with something because it came out of a political blog and in fact maybe changed the way that they were covering a story or started to cover something that they weren't covering before because it came up in a political blog?
Well, the classic example of this was, of course, the Dan Rather 60 Minutes to Memogate affair, where it was in right-wing conservative political blogs, a lot of the initial questions about the likelihood of those memos being factual, authentic documents came up, and it spiraled to Dan Rather's peril and horror out of there. And in fact, that was one of the first really blog-throughs of blogs sort of grabbing the throat of the mainstream media more than the attention. Mm-hmm. During the Lebanon-Israel-Hezbollah war, there was a very interesting phenomenon going on where conservative blogs, right-wing blogs, were critiquing the photography, news photography coming out from the press services and others from Lebanon, saying basically, hey, this is just Hezbollah, you know, PR photography, pointing out faking of photos, issues of captioning of photos. They caught a couple of Photoshop fakes. The wonderful term "faux" instead of photography, F-A-U-X, photography, came out of there. Journalists are paying attention. If you notice, most websites now for newspapers have a comments feature, and the journalists I talk to say that they either read them, the comments, or they're afraid of the comments, or they're resentful of the comments, because you put up a story, and it used to be that maybe 6 weeks later or two days later, you got your editor say, hey, you got a letter here. Some reader didn't like your story. Well, now, you know, you write a story and 15 minutes later, 100 people are saying you're a moron on your newspaper's website. So it's changing the way that journalists sort of think about the public and also what's being written, I think.
And that's something I think you can argue both ways. Either you can find some way to argue that that's a good thing, or maybe you can find some way to argue that it's not such a good thing. Do you think it can be and is both?
Well, what I tell people who say that this is the end of the world is that the end of the world began in 1776, because when we had a revolution and then we started writing the Constitution and we have this phrase about freedom of the press, this one vocation that has these special freedoms. The press that they were talking about then was a press that makes blogs look like the ladies' tea cotillion. They were angry partisan newspapers at the time. They were not advertiser-supported. They supported political parties, and so they were telling you why Thomas Jefferson was evil or why John Adams was evil, and that was the press. They didn't mean the New York Times as much as when they said bare arms meant thermonuclear weapons. They had no idea that a press would be a huge, giant corporation that at least claimed to be objective. They thought of the press as angry individuals. So if you don't like blogging, well, you have to go back pretty far to complain about it.
Is there, though, some danger that because a blogger you can create your blog and you can put anything on there that you want, at the very least, it can be something for circulating, so it was something that doesn't really rise much above the level of gossip or rumor. And at the worst, it can be something that could be really very destructive. And I suppose that we could find examples, at least in terms of what can happen to people's personal reputations, examples of that, in fact, having happened.
Well, as an educator, there's two dangers. One is when you talk to students and they believe that anything that's on the web must be true because it's up there. And the fact is that there's amazing conspiracy, crazy data viruses that are floating up with websites attached of just dead wrong information. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you wouldn't want a situation where people just denied everything. Just said, oh, everything's faked. Everybody's lying to me. We do have a crisis of authority, a crisis of authenticity about who are the experts, you know, who should we respect. And one of the interesting things about blogging is when you ask people which blogs they read and which blogs they read consistently, they will say something like, well, I've grown to respect the blogger. The blogger, for example, one thing bloggers do, which is I was always thought is a big heads up over regular journalism, is the very good bloggers will tell you, oh, you know what, yesterday I said this and I was wrong. Sorry, guys, I really blew it on that one. This is how I blew it. Sorry. You don't see that often in traditional journalism. In the same space, making a correction as was the original error. So that's how you gain respect in the blog world.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Let me again introduce our guest, David Perlmutter. He is professor and associate dean for graduate studies and research at the William Allen White School of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Kansas. He is the author or editor of 7 books and many research articles on politics and the media. And he is the author of the book Blog Wars. Oxford University Press is the publisher, and it's a book that takes a look at the rise of the political blog and asks some questions about its impact. And questions here are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think it's true that candidates and campaigns have, not only are they paying attention to blogs and bloggers and what they write, that they are also, in a way, trying to find ways to draw them in, to use them. In what ways have campaigns done things like that?
Well, I think early in political campaigns, they thought bloggers would be some sort of town hall constituency where the candidate would get up and ask them, do you have any questions? And they'd answer questions. Now it's much more sophisticated. They're actually hiring bloggers to work for the campaign. They're hiring blog outreach coordinators. They're writing their own posts and trying to place them on blogs. John Edwards was sort of a pioneer of this, that every time he would go someplace and give a speech, he would have a special bloggers-only luncheon with the local bloggers, and then, of course, his speech would be written up in the local political blogs. You're going to see all variations thereof. Most sophisticated political organizations understand bloggers are not some mass out there who will follow orders and do exactly what they're told. It's a herd of cats. And so the ways that the people will try to influence them that will be successful will be more sophisticated than just a press release.
We have a caller here, somebody who's calling on a cell phone, so let's get to them right here, line number 4. Hello.
Oh, yes. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about anonymity and specifically how the top political web bloggers, how many of them blog anonymously, and have there been any cases where they've suffered personally or professionally because of that? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Okay. Well, that's a good question.
As far as I know, almost all the top political bloggers blog. They may blog under a pseudonym, but you know who they are, or they'll say elsewhere, this, you know, so-and-so is a pseudonym for me. There are a lot of issues about political blogging or any kind of blogging. People have been fired for blogging about their company or their employer. I've had bloggers tell me that they stopped blogging because of the negativity of that they got when somebody revealed their identity to somebody else at their company and they were politically blogging. The two times that I've blogged under a pseudonym because I just didn't feel comfortable coming out with certain political positions at the same time that I was writing a book about blogging. And I think for a number of people in sort of sensitive professions, maybe government officials, they do it anonymously. But generally, the top political bloggers, they may have a nom de plume, but you know who they are if you just, you know, click on the About Me page. For medium and lower level blogging, that's where much more likely people are going to hide under, and for good reason, under a name.
For those people who might say that they've never read one, if you if they're interested in going out and sampling some, are there some that you can cite that maybe you wouldn't say that they were the best, but maybe the most influential or most widely read?
Sure. Well, certainly you go to the major ones that on either side. And by the way, my one suggestion about blog reading that I give to my students is that don't only read blogs that you agree with. Blogs are very democratic compared to a newspaper front page, and even bloggers who have a strong political position will often hyperlink the articles in the opposing blogs that they say that they're attacking, but then you get to read them, which is sort of different than the newspaper. But read both sides, and then you, at least you, in a very traditional marketplace sense, you could sort of compare and contrast. The major ones on the left, like if you go to Daily Kos or Daily Kos or Huffington Post, which is a lot tends to have more liberal left blogs on it, and just peruse and see who they're citing, who they're reading, Town Hall, Powerline blog, RedState.com on the right. I think it's one of those things where I'm always hesitant to say, here are the four bloggers you must read. Mm-hmm. Out of the 100 million, if you just spend a day cruising, you'll find some very interesting people out there. And again, the proof is in the daily pudding, just reading day after day and seeing, is this person convincing? Does this person seem rational? Are they getting their facts right? And you can build a relationship.
Do you think that it is true that most people who are reading blogs are mostly reading blogs that express a political viewpoint that they're already in harmony with?
That's a tendency that's been shown in some of the surveys that, liberal Democrats tend to read liberal Democratic blogs. But, again, because it's interactive, because it's online, there's more of an ability to click through to see what the right-winger is saying on the same issue. So I actually think in some ways you get more of a compare and contrast feature than you would if you were just reading a partisan newspaper.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that there, again, that points to one of the big differences between the blog and older kind of media, and that is there is that possibility that you're writing something and you're saying, well, here, this person said this, and I think that they're wrong for this reason, but here, you can click on this link and you can go and you can read what that other person said. It makes it very easy to go back and forth or to sample a wider range of opinion just by mouse click. And that certainly is that the business of the hyperlink probably is one of the significant things that is different. And I think a lot of people would argue would be an advancement in making it possible for people to get various kinds of information and a fairly wide range of information, or at least when it comes to politics and political opinion.
Yes. But as I've often found with students, that you have to sort of encourage them, because there's a sort of natural human tendency to seek out feedback that fits. So, you have a strong position one way or another on the surge in Iraq. Yeah, there's a tendency to want to find information that supports our position. I think the wonder of the Internet in general and social interactive media in particular is that with a little bit of energy and enthusiasm, we can find things that we disagree with and maybe learn something.
Well, if we again try to get to this question of in what way have political blogs changed politics, there certainly are people who would say, well, that changes everything, that somehow this is a revolutionary change. And I think your suggestion is, well, be careful about using terms like revolutionary, that it certainly is important and it does indeed change things. But can you say, do you think at least at this point, generally the Internet and political blogs specifically, have they changed politics?
Yes, and I think you'll see in 2008 that campaigns are run differently than they were in 1968. But the key is that the new technology is not displacing and replacing the old. We're still going to have a lot of money spent on television ads. We're still going to have get out the vote door to door with precinct workers. We're still going to have buses of people going from the old age homes and from the churches. I mean, a lot of what a ward boss for Franklin Roosevelt in the 30s would recognize in New York City is still going to go on. But we'll also have this new layer of different kinds of so-called new media. That'll all happen at the same time. And the successful campaign will be the one that'll figure out a way to marry them all together.
Where do you think that this technology is headed? And what is going to be the next This is obviously a difficult thing to predict. It wouldn't have been all that long ago that not that many people were predicting that we would have the internet maybe the growth of almost instantaneous, or maybe that I should say, an instantaneous access to a wide range of information with a device that you can put in your pocket or at least carry easily with you. Do you have some thought about where this is all going?
Well, I guess you can just progress forward that 20 years from now we'll be walking around with these computer chips in our head, that if we want the every detail about the Spanish-American War will just be instantly there, which will bring classrooms cheating into a new arena. So you turn off, I have to go around and press the side of the head of the student to turn off their PDA in their head. But I think the challenge that everyone agrees now we face is not access to information, it's too much information. That where do you go for the right search to find the right information for that it's authentic, it's accurate, that somebody's verified it. And so that's an exploration that I think has to be done by the human mind. It's not just a technological one. It's not just a better widget. And so I happen to think, and again, I'm a strong partisan in this, that a traditional liberal arts education, whether it's something that people figure out a way to do it themselves or they do through the college or university, is still going to be important, because we need people to think about information and try to understand what it means, and I just don't think that a better iPhone is going to do that for us.
All right. Our guest is David Perlmutter. He is professor and associate dean for graduate studies and research at the William Allen White School of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Kansas, and is author of the book Blog Wars. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.